read your briefs, we've read the record excerpts, and we've read most of the cases you cited. So give us your best argument, please.
May it please the court. The issue before the court is whether the government proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Isaias Esparza was an alien, that is, someone who is a non-citizen of the United States. Specifically, in light of a properly constituted nunk-pro-tunk judgment granting legal custody of Mr. Isaias Esparza to his United States citizen father, whether, in light of that, the government sustained its burden of proof that Mr. Isaias Esparza was, in fact, an alien. The answer is no, and that is the conclusion the district court would have arrived at had it applied the proper legal standard. Instead, the district court answered the wrong question. In the court's own words, the question the district court focused on was whether the court can and should recognize the defendant's derivative citizenship. And that puts the district court in the position of acting as an immigration judge instead of a judge of a criminal court. And the judge applied this court's decision in Bustamante Barrera as though that was the controlling legal standard. It is not, for a few reasons. First, Bustamante Barrera is an immigration case, and in immigration context, the petitioner bears the burden of proof to demonstrate that he is, in fact, a derivative citizen. Second, in Bustamante Barrera, there was evidence of fraud, that the nunk-pro-tunk judgment was acquired solely for the purpose of manipulating the outcome of these immigration proceedings. There's no such evidence here.
Well, why did your client seek the nunk-pro-tunk judgment?
By the terms...
The timing seems highly suspect. It did to the district court, and it does to me, speaking.
Certainly, Your Honor. First, I will point, Your Honor, to the motion for entering the nunk-pro-tunk judgment, which itself recites that it is sought for the purpose of correcting an error. As to the timing, and I agree on the face, the timing might seem suspicious. However, I suspect that there are frequently mistakes in divorce decrees that don't go corrected until there are legal consequences to those errors. So although and I think it's worth noting that in Bustamante as well as in Fierro, there was admitted fraud. There was no legal reason to grant the nunk-pro-tunk order. And here we had a mistake that was corrected.
What was that mistake?
The mistake was granting legal custody of Mr. Isaias Esparza to his father instead of his mother.
You mean that's not what the original decree said?
The original decree granted custody to the mother. The mistake that was corrected in the nunk-pro-tunk was changing that to the judge's original spoken decision, which was to grant it to the father.
And what evidence was there of what the judge's original spoken decision was?
Well, I don't have the tape recording of what the judge said, but that there was a mistake is supported by the way the child support payments were calculated. There were five children in the family, but child support was granted for only four, which does tend to support the idea that custody of one child was not given to the mother.
But he was almost 18, wasn't he, at the time?
He was 17, yes.
Yeah. So he wasn't going to be entitled to child support that long, correct?
I assume while he is under someone's legal custody as a minor, he would be entitled to child support. There's no evidence to the contrary that he was not.
Even if Esparza's father was the managing conservator, does that actually give rise to sole custody?
There's no indication that there was joint custody. He was given managing, he was the managing conservator under the nunk-pro-tunk.
Does Esparza's mother's possessory conservatorship weaken that claim, though?
I do not believe so. Under the nunk-pro-tunk order, he had both. The father is, I'm looking at record page 62, And it says, it is ordered and decreed that Juan Isais, that's Mr. Isais Esparza's father, is appointed possessory conservator and managing conservator of Juan Isais Jr., that's Mr. Isais Esparza.
So it was linked. Both of them were in the nunc pro tunc.
Correct, Your Honor. And there, that actually was not disputed by the government below, that the nunc pro tunc, if taken at face value, would be insufficient to be considered legal custody at, in terms of immigration, 8 United States Code 1432A. That part was not at issue.
Am I correct in understanding that there is no prior case involving these same facts?
You are correct, Your Honor.
And why should we now decide the way you want us to decide it?
Because the government failed to carry its burden of proof as to alienage beyond a reasonable doubt. This is like any other defense for which—
there's no question that this individual was born in Mexico.
That's correct.
And it is only the occurrence of whatever relief he may have been entitled to under the act of that you've pledged yourself under that would make him anything other than an alien, right?
You mean but for the nunc pro tunc judgment, he would be an alien?
He applied for citizenship under some other statute at a time when he could have raised this same issue.
He could have, Your Honor, but that really doesn't bear on whether the government proved that he's an alien. That goes to whether—
What do you mean it doesn't bear upon?
Because this information wasn't before the immigration court. And also, Mr. Isais Esparza was in immigration custody, and he simply grew tired of waiting for things to come together for him to demonstrate his case, because he had just spent time in federal custody on a criminal charge. The information was not there for the immigration court to consider. And I think that's kind of where the district court took a turn, incorrect. The district court required Mr. Isais Esparza to prove to some sort of near certitude that he was indeed a derivative citizen, when really it's the government's burden to prove that he is, to a near certitude, an illegal alien.
And do you have a case that tells us that's the government's burden?
Yes, Your Honor. I cited a few cases. It's in the jury instructions as well. Alienage is an element. So it rests with the government to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
Do you have any cases that you want to specifically refer us to?
Certainly, Your Honor. First, I point the court to the jury instructions for the offense, which is 8 United States Code 1326. And also, I would cite to the court Garcia Ruiz, which is on page 10 of my brief, 546 F. 3rd, 716. 2008.
What evidentiary value, if any, should be given to Esparza's parents' May 8, 2010 unsworn statements providing that Esparza was living with his father from the time of the divorce until Esparza was 19?
Honestly, Your Honor, I think those are a red herring.
They're a red herring. We can't use those, even though they would help your case.
You can use them. I don't know that they really help, because where he was living
is not dispositive.
Correct.
Legal custody arrangement.
Correct, Your Honor. And the only reason that those were not intended for submission in the first place, if you look at the transcript of the bench trial, the district court seemed to think it was an immigration court and kept asking Mr. Isais Esparza, do you have any more evidence? Do you have any more evidence? But really, the best evidence of who had legal custody of him is what happened in Texas state court. It isn't this affidavit, unsworn or undated or however it wound up in the court's possession.
But that didn't happen until 16 years after the critical time, which is when the initial division of the parents occurred.
Well, Your Honor.
And at that time, the defendant was a minor, but he has since ceased to be a minor. And as I read the statute, it's talking about minor children at the time of the assessment of the derivative of citizenship.
That's correct, Your Honor. It does speak of minor children. But a nunk-pro-tunk judgment, the whole purpose of it, nunk-pro-tunk means now for then. It goes back to 1994, and as of 1994, it fixes the error.
Well, I recognize that that is the concept behind a nunk-pro-tunk. What I want to know is, did you tell the new judge, who was not the judge at the time of the divorce decree, the reason for getting a nunk-pro-tunk?
Yes, Your Honor. The motion cites that it was for purpose of correcting a mistake in the original.
And did you tell them that that correcting of a mistake was going to have a bearing on the question of citizenship?
Well, I was not the attorney in that proceeding.
I'm not asking you whether you were. Does it show up in the pleadings of the reason why you wanted to enter a nunk-pro-tunk was to affect the question of the defendant's citizenship?
It does not appear in the proceedings that are part of this record.
Right.
But those proceedings, that nunk-pro-tunk judgment, is entitled to a presumption of regularity. There's no evidence here that the judge who entered it, who took an oath, swore to uphold the law, acted ultra vires, and entered an order that he had no power to enter. These nunk-pro-tunk judgments are for the purpose of correcting errors.
But couldn't Judge Ellison, when he was evaluating the credibility of the case before him, couldn't he find the original order more credible than the 16-year later supposed correction of a mistake?
Not without more, Your Honor. The fact that it's on its face is a duly entered order. The government was free to bring forward evidence that it was a sham or somehow not correct or there was any legal irregularity with it.
Can you look at the inference of motive? Wasn't that before him?
It was before him, but that would be mere speculation in the absence of any evidence to that effect. The timing alone cannot be dispositive where the order is facially valid.
All right, do you have anything else?
Yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to speak briefly about how this defense is like any other defense for which the defendant does not bear the burden. It's like identity or alibi or anything else where the defendant has some evidence that he was not the person who committed the offense or was not in the place where the offense was committed. We don't require that defendant to establish to a near certitude that he was not the person who committed the offense. At all times, the government bears the burden of proving all of the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. So for all those reasons, we request that the court reverse this conviction.
Let me ask this. I'm just trying to make sure I understand. It's your position that, you know, obviously the facial reason is that it didn't accord with the oral pronouncement. And you're not disputing the timing is related. You know, we could infer that the timing is related to the immigration consequences, but that's not unusual for a nunk-pro-tunk. Once you realize something's wrong in another context, it's okay to go back and fix it. That's not sinister.
Correct.
Is that your position?
That is my position, Your Honor, and that is what distinguishes it from Bustamante, Barrera, and Fierro.
So you're not saying, oh, it was for a totally different purpose that we went back, that the other people went back 16 years later and that he would have done it anyway just because he wanted to have it on the record in his baby book that he was with his dad. You're not disputing it, that it may have had some relationship to this important citizenship proceeding.
Certainly, Your Honor, but it's not a legal fiction.
Right.
That it actually reflects what
if it reflects what actually happened before, if this is what caused it to bring it to their attention, there's nothing sinister or bad that would cause you to discount it without further proof. Is that your whole position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Should we attribute any significance to the fact that the U.S. Congress has repealed the very statutory provision under which you are claiming?
No, Your Honor.
Do you have any case that instructs us on that issue?
I would be glad to provide one upon rebuttal. I need a moment to look up the case that says that you apply the naturalization statute in effect at the time.
You save time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good
Barry.
Good morning. Richard Barry for the United States. May it please the court, Ms. Landau. If I could, I'd like to begin with Judge Clement's question as to Judge Ellison's role as the trier of fact. Judge Ellison was the trier of fact. It was a bench trial. There was a single issue for determination in the trial, whether or not the original 1994 decree was valid or whether the 2010 nunk-pro-tunk decree was valid, as that question would resolve whether or not Mr. Esparza had a claim to derivative citizenship by virtue of having been given to his father as the managing conservator. Judge Ellison examined the two orders. Judge Ellison asked both parties for briefing, and he received briefing. There was substantial argument at the bench trial. Judge Ellison said that he found the 1994 order dispositive of the issue, and on its face, there was nothing to call into question the 1994 order. As a Texas practitioner, Judge Ellison would have been aware of the fact that the order was, in all probability, not prepared by the state district judge, but by the attorney representing the Esparzas at the time of the divorce. As he set out at the hearing, the 1994 decree was presumptively valid. It stated on its face that the parties were present. It stated on its face that the parties were represented by counsel. The decree disposed of all the issues in the case. And as of the time of the decree, as Judge Elrod and Judge Clement both noted, Mr. Esparza was 17. However, the decree was entered June the 24th of 1994. Mrs. Esparza would have been entitled to child support until Mr. Esparza, or junior, reached the age of 18, which occurred September the 2nd. In other words, he was 17 for only two more months. Assuming, strictly for the sake of argument, that there is some sort of irregularity in the child support, I would note that the parties were free to amend that, although the what are now the Chapter 152 guidelines are highly advisory. They are only advisory. The parties are free to amend them by agreement. The PSR discloses that Mr. Esparza had already quit school by the time his parents divorced. He was gainfully employed to help his mother support his four younger siblings, and it might well be that there was simply no need to include him on the child support order for the remaining 2 months of his minority. Whatever the case, an irregularity or a potential irregularity in the child support order is not enough to call the 1994 decree into question.
But wasn't that a question for the state district court, not for Judge Ellison or for us today to look behind?
Well, that comes to the standard of review. As to Judge Ellison, I would respectfully submit that as the trier of fact, it was a question for Judge Ellison. He was presented with conflicting decrees and charged with deciding which of the two he should believe.
Well, I have a question about that, too. Did he follow the standard that was required of him, which was beyond a reasonable doubt with the government bearing the burden? Is that reflected in this record, or did he in fact use a different analysis?
I believe that he did, Your Honor.
What evidence in the record supports that he used beyond the burden, beyond a reasonable doubt, and required the government to meet its proof?
Your Honor, at several points during the bench trial, he said the burden is on the United States, the burden is on the government beyond a reasonable doubt. The parties repeatedly said the only issue is alienage, the derivative citizenship question. Judge Ellison took the matter under advisement and later issued a written opinion. And in the opinion, and I'm not finding it right this second. In the opinion, Judge Ellison plainly states that the burden is on the United States and not the defendant, is on the United States to prove alienage beyond a reasonable doubt as one of the elements of a 1326B violation, as opposed to on Mr. Esparza to prove derivative citizenship.
What evidence in the record is there that this was a sham? You note this the fact that the parties prepare judgments, and as a former state district judge, I'm not sure exactly where you're going with that argument and why we should look beyond. I think it's quite something to call a state district judge's order a sham with no support whatsoever, and I'm asking what evidence in the record supports that this was indeed a sham. It impugns the state district court, your argument, doesn't it, counsel?
No, Your Honor, I respectfully submit that it does not. The 2010 order is bolstered, or would be bolstered, by the parents' affidavit, as Ms. Landau conceded in part, and as noted by Judge Ellison. The affidavits are missing critical dates. They do not state.
They weren't affidavits, were they? They weren't sworn.
I don't believe that they were. They were.
Well, the question is not what bolstered their position, but what supported your position that it was a sham, which you have to look beyond a signed order by a state district judge. So what supports your position that it was a sham that was presented to Judge Ellison?
Okay, the 2010 decree purported to replace the 1994 decree. As of 2010, all five children had reached majority. So there was no issue of who was the managing or possessory conservator. In fact, one of Mr. Esparza's siblings had unfortunately passed away.
Well, there was an issue because it implicated his derivative citizenship, so it brought that to his attention.
But that was the only issue. That was the only reason for
but
the order.
If that's when he noticed the order and he needed to go back and get it, and then he realized, oh, my goodness, it doesn't purport with what the judge decreed, we need to get this changed. Is there a mechanism under state law where we do the then to now? Yes, there is. So what it shows that that's a sham?
Judge Ellison noted the fact that it was 16 years after the fact, that there was no other reason to get the nunk-pro-tunk order other than to affect the then criminal proceedings, but that the nunk-pro-tunk order wasn't sought
but
until
what
after he's been
sham?
Indicted.
What shows that it was not true or dishonest? The fact that it's late, all nunk-pro-tunks are after the fact, sometimes many years, even more than 16 years. Doesn't show that it's a sham. What shows it's a sham?
All of the facts and circumstances surrounding the order. It's presented as an agreed order because the only parties in interest actually would have been his parents. It doesn't actually resolve any issue. All the children had reached the age of majority. The only purpose would be retroactively to change his citizenship after he had applied for an acknowledgement of citizenship from immigration and been denied that.
I feel like we're talking across purposes. The fact that it had that effect and the fact that that may have been the desired effect doesn't render it a sham. It has to be that there was some untruth or dishonesty associated with the information contained in the order, or that it was done from gain, financial gain, that there's something unseemly or bad about it, something illegal or dishonest to be a sham.
The timing was after the indictment, correct?
The timing was after the arrest and after the indictment. It was literally done to game the system, if you will.
But game the system in a legitimate fashion. I mean, what does game the system mean? To go back and establish something that should have been right at the time.
To go back 16 years after the fact and explain why, since the family code directs the only interest in a divorce is the best interest of the children, a state district judge sitting in a divorce decree with the parties present would have awarded a 17-year-old, almost an 18-year-old child, to a father who, by the son's own admission, had problems with alcohol, was physically abusive, and was verbally abusive, to the point that Mr. Esparza volunteered to the probation officer. Esparza took physical beatings to prevent his then mother and siblings.
Is that in the record as to why this was a sham?
It's in the PSR. Judge Ellison looked at the facts and circumstances surrounding the 2010 decree and literally concluded that the only purpose for the nunk-pro-tunk order was to change Esparza's citizenship.
What do we do with the language in Bustamante Barrera that says that there could be a situation in which a nunk-pro-tunk decree could enhance an alien's claim of derivative citizenship? It's almost recognized in Bustamante Barrera that that's a legitimate purpose of the nunk-pro-tunk.
It is a dicta observation. There could be. This is not that case. Bustamante Barrera and Fierro do not control this because they are appeals from the Board of Immigration Appeals, but both cases stand for the proposition that an alien cannot, after the fact, get an order changing his or her citizenship, and in both cases, his citizenship.
Did you bring in evidence to Judge Ellison that said this has to be a sham because he wasn't a good father, and so he could not have possibly gotten managing conservatorship? Did you bring that before the trial, or was that only after the fact?
That was after the fact.
So that we can't consider that in deciding whether the evidence beyond a reasonable doubt showed this was a sham, can we?
No, Your Honor, but you can consider the fact that there was literally no purpose for getting the 2010 non-proton order other than to attempt to change Esparza's citizenship after the fact to pretermit the possibility of another extended stay in the Bureau of Prisons.
Do you have any authority that would meet your standard for beyond a reasonable doubt?
In this court, yes, I certainly do. Cavazos versus Smith, 132. Supreme Court Reporter, page 2. Six members of the Supreme Court went back to Glasser versus United States and Jackson versus Virginia and said the only test on appeal is whether a rational trier of fact could conclude each and every element of the offense of conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. Cavazos deals with a California case in which a grandmother was sleeping with her granddaughter. The granddaughter is found to be unresponsive and, in fact, dead. An investigation ensues. The grandmother's charged with murder. There's extensive medical testimony, three state experts and two defense experts. The three state experts say that the child apparently died of shaken baby syndrome. The two defense experts state that the child apparently died from sudden infant death syndrome, and therefore no crime's been committed. The jury agreed with the state of California and found Ms. Smith guilty. The U.S. Supreme Court reversed the Ninth Circuit three separate times on habeas review. The third and final time, concluding with a reference back to Jackson and Glasser versus United States, and if I could read you just one single sentence, Jackson unambiguously instructs that a reviewing court, faced with a record of historical facts that support conflicting inferences, must presume, even if it does not affirmatively appear in the record, that the trier of fact resolved any such conflicts in favor of the prosecution and must defer to that resolution. And although, as Ms. Landau correctly points out, this court has repeatedly held, if the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the prosecution, gives equal or nearly equal circumstantial support to a theory of guilt and a theory of innocence, a defendant is entitled to a judgment of acquittal. I would respectfully submit that that is in direct conflict with Glasser and Jackson and Cavazos versus Smith.
Counsel, let me ask some questions about another aspect. When Congress repealed the derivative citizenship statute, did they make any statement or any finding as to its future applicability?
Your Honor, I'm sorry to say I do not know the answer to that question.
All right. I would appreciate if you and opposing counsel would address that question as to what did the Congress say when they repealed this statutory relief provision. I could understand if they had something in there that said it would not affect pending claims. But if they repealed it, and at that time this defendant had made no claim under the derivative statute, I'm wondering if, in the minds of the Congress, the remedy was still available. And I would appreciate whatever you and opposing counsel can develop as a way of prior precedence on that subject.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. We would both be delighted to do that.
All right.
As I stated, Judge Ellison was faced with two conflicting pieces of evidence. He resolved that conflict in favor of the United States.
May I ask a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Two conflicting pieces of evidence. I'm wondering if this case raises issues of federalism. Did he really have two conflicting pieces of evidence? Because once the nunk-pro-tunk has been issued, the other judgment is a nullity under state law. So why is he faced with two judgments? Why isn't he only faced with one valid state court judgment? And if we look behind state court judgments and say, oh, this other one that you've declared invalid is really the valid one, aren't we interfering with the state's enforcement of its own family law, a traditional area of state domain? That's not artfully phrased, but you see the question. Does he even have a right to look at the first judgment when the first judgment's a nullity after the second one's been entered?
It is very artfully phrased, Your Honor, and I believe I see your question. First, the question of nationality is an exclusive federal area for the reasons set out in our brief.
I agree with that.
But as to the state judgments, the nunk-pro-tunk order would supplant the original 1994 decree, but for the fact that on the face of the, given the timing of the nunk-pro-tunk order, Judge Ellison was more than entitled to wonder if there was not something irregular in the 2010 nunk-pro-tunk order.
But it is, you would agree, that it's looking behind what the state court has declared in an area that's traditionally referred to the states. In state court, that would be a nullity, and the nunk-pro-tunk would have supplanted it. And any state court would have to look to the nunk-pro-tunk.
A nunk-pro-tunk order under state law, of course, can only issue to correct a clerical error.
Right, but that's for the state court to decide if it was proper to issue a nunk-pro-tunk. If it didn't meet the standards for nunk-pro-tunk, that should have been argued back in the state court. We don't look behind state rules for state nunk-pro-tunks. But once it's issued, it has the effect of supplanting the other one. Doesn't it, counsel?
It does if it's validly issued, Your Honor. I don't think that any nunk-pro-tunk order would be entitled to full faith and credit in the federal system.
So by what authority do we look behind what the state court has done? What entitles us to look behind the state court's order and say, your order that you say is a nullity is really the one in effect, and the one that you said is not a nullity is not in effect? What gives us the power to do that in an area of family law?
The fact that it's not an area of family law, it's an area of federal criminal law. The only disputed element for the 1326 violation is whether or not Mr. Sparza is an alien. That is something for the federal courts to decide.
But to decide that one state judgment is valid and another is not. What, do we have any authority for that in any context?
We do, Your Honor, and I'm sorry I don't have a case in front of me, but I will find one for you.
Thank you. Trial judge. In this case, has to evaluate credibility, and the validity of the document would be something before him as a finder of facts, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, it would. The two state documents would be literally two conflicting pieces
the
of evidence.
Federal immigration and federal criminal.
Precisely, Your Honor. If there's nothing further, I'll surrender the rest of my time.
All right. Ms. Landau, you have 5 minutes. If you would address Judge DeMoss's question, can file a 28-J letter, whatever is preferable.
I think at least part of the question is answered on page 10 of the opening brief. And in Ashton versus Gonzalez, which is a Second Circuit case, 431 F3rd 95, at page 97, the court said, to determine whether a person obtained U.S. citizenship as a result of his parents' naturalization, we apply the law in effect when the person fulfilled the last requirement for derivative citizenship. So in this case, applying that principle means we would go back to 1994 and look at what the law is at that time. And in fact, that is what Bustamante Barrera and Fierro did in the immigration context. So I think that part is correct in this case. To move to responding to the government's arguments, the government in this case led the district court down the incorrect path. The government argued that the court couldn't even look at whether Mr. Isaias Esparza would have been a derivative citizen. This is what the government said, that his derivative citizenship is something for him to file with the immigration courts after review of records to see if he does have a valid claim. Right now before you, he stands as an undocumented alien, and the paperwork and all the documents show just exactly that. And then the government urged the court to apply Bustamante and hold that Mr. Isaias Esparza had not met his burden of demonstrating. And that's exactly what the district court did. And this is the wrong legal standard. At a minimum, the court should remand for the court to district court to apply the correct legal standard. But I submit to you that in light of a facially valid nunk-pro-tunk order, there simply is not enough evidence as to alienage to meet the rigorous standard under Jackson versus Virginia of to a subjective state of near certitude. That is what the government has to demonstrate. And the fact that there's this back and forth about which document controls, I don't know what the effect was, his father was this way, he couldn't have been granted custody, that is reasonable doubt right there. The government did not sustain its burden. And in fact, this sham...
Judge Ellison's opinion identify that the burden of proof was with the government, his written opinion?
I don't know that those words were used, but the court did say that Mr. Isaias Esparza had not met his burden under Bustamante, which would negate that the court was placing the burden properly. So it is possible that the court, I can get back to the court about what exactly it said on what page, but the court at the end, at the analysis portion, did say that Mr. Isaias Esparza did not make the required showing under Bustamante, which negates the idea that the government has the burden of proof, which is obviously the correct one. And in fact, the government disavowed any sham argument before the district court. On page 27, the government's attorney says, I'm not suggesting it's a sham by any means. I'm not trying to suggest that another judge did something improper. I'm suggesting and saying that when two parties agree and then there's a discussion not based on evidence about how these nunk-pro-tunk judgments work in state court. And it isn't a competing interest of one judgment versus another. The effect of the nunk-pro-tunk is to negate the prior judgment. So the judge also misapplied the law by saying, I don't know whether to give this nunk-pro-tunk judgment credence. It's not sufficient to dislodge the 1994 divorce decree, when by its terms, that's exactly what it does. Without any evidence of sham or improper behavior or oath breaking or anything else, the district court had to give it credence.
Counsel, have you found any other case in which derivative citizenship has been recognized and awarded on an ex post facto basis after the Congress repealed the statute under which those claims would have been made?
I can certainly find one, Your Honor. I think that the fact that the courts in Fierro and also in Bustamante Barrera did apply retroactively the immigration statute in effect at the time the person fulfilled the final condition of citizenship indicates that that is the correct approach.
Counsel, are we...
No question about applying the statute retroactively as long as the statute was in existence. What I'm asking you is, have you found a case after Congress repealed the statute that the question of derivative citizenship was decided on a retroactive basis?
Yes, Your Honor. Bustamante Barrera was decided in 2006, and the statute at issue would have been repealed in 2000.
Counsel, do we open the floodgates for people to claim derivative citizenship? I mean, we have to decide the case and the law, but is there a potential practical problem if we were to rule with you?
You know, I thought about that, Your Honor. The two cases that are relied upon by the government here do mention opening the floodgates, but given that it's 2012 and this is the first case of its kind, I think the facts that would be required under a repealed statute are so rare to obtain a nunk-pro-tunk judgment that I don't think there are any floodgates to open here.
All right, thank you. You can both have until next Tuesday if you want to file a 28-J letter on the effect of the repeal that Judge DeMoss has raised.